Right now, it is time to bring in David Terachuk. It's time for the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday. We rebroadcast it over the weekends and also after our Monday 12 noon news. David is a PBS television correspondent. He reports on ethics and belief. He's got his own terrific website called themediabeat.us. That's where you can find it. But you can also find him right here live on a Friday morning. Good morning, David.
Well, good to be with you, reporting in again from the media capital of the world, New York City.
Well, we had a moment this week where a police officer was convicted on all counts, basically of murder, ranging on three different counts. And during the trial, that thin blue line opened up to let police officers and heads of the police department come in and do something that we don't normally see, which is testify against a fellow officer.
Yeah, a unusual sight of a policeman being convicted, or a police officer of any kind, being a sheriff, city cop, or whatever, being charged and, in this case, found guilty of killing an individual. The flow of such events is extraordinary in this country. Well, we have an armed police force, and I suppose in some ways we should not be surprised. And of course, there is the long-lasting history of law enforcement being an arm of subjugation of minority populations, especially those of previously enslaved populations. So I guess we should not be surprised by numbers that I think we would, if we stepped away from this country and came back to it, we'd be horrified by, and in fact we should be horrified as citizens living in the country. Something like 1,000 people are killed by police officers every year. So a phenomenon that happened this week that prompted a few people I know to say, my goodness, you know, are there more black individuals being killed by police this week, or is it just because of the Derek Chauvin conviction? Journalists are now, you know, feeling, you know, that the agenda is now changed somewhat, and these cases should be more reported. We had, of course, the case of Daunte Wright of 20 in Minneapolis, or very close to Minneapolis itself also, and Micaiah Bryant, only 16-year-old girl, killed in Ohio, and Andrew Brown in his early 40s. In Daunte Wright's case, during a traffic stop, and in Andrew Brown's case, the serving of a search warrant at his house. Are these somehow, a sign of increasing numbers? No, I'm afraid not. It's just that it probably is true that the cases are now leaping to the top of newsrooms' agendas because of what happened in the murder of George Floyd. But as I say, with 1,000 such cases a year, it's in essence three a day. In this country, that's a hard truth to face, but it is true. And of course, the unavoidable statistic that if you're black, you're between two and three times more likely to be killed by a police officer than you are if you're white. So this landmark case in the murder of George Floyd. And the conviction of Derek Chauvin, the fired police officer, it may mark something of a watershed. But on the other hand, as the president himself talking about this murder committed for almost 10 minutes in broad daylight, as he emphasized, we have now got a very clear demonstration of how much more work has to be still done to change the overall picture. There was almost jubilation in certain quarters about the conviction of Derek Chauvin, but much more appropriately, I think. There's been much emphasis on the fact that this is a problem that is not, that is by no means going away with one big and very important case being settled in such a definitive way.
You know, I don't know if there was jubilation, but I can certainly tell you America was holding its breath and there was a nice, long, big exhale.
There was great relief indeed, yeah.
All right, now you want the our call to the post here?
I think we need a fanfare.
Okay.
Let's hear it.
All right.
That's our fanfare for good work. I want to tune in with your proud boast at WHDD Robin Hood Radio as the smallest, you say this all the time, the smallest NPR station in the nation. My fanfare this week goes to national NPR efforts, especially a couple of voices that are familiar on your airwaves at Robin Hood Radio doing really good work. Martin Casti first. Martin Casti is the law enforcement specialist amongst the very good reporters of the NPR National Newsroom, and he pointed out in an extraordinary story this week about in the wake of the continuing cases of police killings, he concentrated on a completely nationally uncoordinated phenomenon of police training done by local jurisdictions. He explored very revealingly the great variety in training and the overall lack of any national oversight in that training. So in consequence, in the great American tradition, I suppose, of all police matters being a matter for local jurisdictions, you end up with standards and the efficacy of training being consequently highly questionable. It was a fine piece of sturdy reporting. And the other example of good NPR work I want to highlight is Tamara Keith, the very prominent, very familiar White House correspondent. But in this case, she went out into the country and almost in a counterintuitive story for a White House correspondent was explaining how much of the vaccine rollout that this administration is employing, you know, with a remarkable meeting of targets, by the way, to 200 million shots in the arm of Americans before President Biden's first 100 days are up. But in her case, she was pointing out that this governmental rollout is being so successful, not entirely through the government's own doing. And indeed, she was pointing out that part of the success was the very fact that the government is, this particular administration anyway, is taking a different tack. And traditional opponents of big government, people you might not expect to be cooperating, like farmers groups in Iowa, for instance, very conservative body of individuals in most contexts, are engaged in spreading the word about people getting vaccinated. Good old common sense, as you might expect for farmers, I hope. But interestingly, it was an interesting demonstration of a certain tension between certain strands in American thinking about government's role, and what's happening here is a very interesting case of cooperation from people who have political differences, but are coming together for the sake of public health. It's a heartening story in many ways, and very well presented by Tamara Keith.
All right, let's move on here because there's some pretty interesting stories on the international level. First of all, the country that produces a huge amount of vaccine for the COVID, India, we have Arjun Singh who reports with us once a month. And Arjun now says that not only his city of Jaisalmer, the whole country on a severe lockdown. Things just have gotten totally out of control in India when it comes to COVID-19.
Sure. India is now in the lead, far from a wanted position. But yes, one of the most populous countries in the world, and now, without doubt, more cases than either the United States or Brazil, who previously been in that sort of unsalubrious position of having the most cases and most deaths. Yes, India is in deep trouble, and it is ironical since the country has taken on the burden because it has the capacity and has demonstrated that over the last 20 years by developing such a competent and fully fully fledged manufacturing capacity for vaccines. It's one of their great export successes. But they are, while exporting vaccines, they desperately need vaccines themselves, and their own rollout isn't succeeding too well within their own frontiers. And indeed, although there is a lockdown, the enormously populous cities of India are rampant territory for the disease. And so, yes, it's the country's in a terrible bind, and let's hope that they manage to get a better grip on it, because a country that big, will necessarily tilt the possibility of the world as a whole beating this pandemic seriously and dangerously because of its sheer size.
Let's come back down to the United States. President Biden puts forth a climate policy that obviously seeks to make up for 4 years of no climate policy, and is really pretty amazing in its asking, which is to reduce carbon emissions by 50% in 10 years. What you say about that, David?
Sure, it's an extraordinary kind of throwing down of the gauntlet, I guess, to American citizens and to the rest of the world, to hold Biden holding a climate summit, to which, by the way, our great rivals Russia and China are invited and came. I mean, came virtually. It was all done by a massive kind of Zoom operation. I'm not sure exactly what platforms used to achieve it, but it had that feel of a crowded Zoom screen that we're all getting very familiar with. And it was held on Earth Day, the 21st of the month of April, and it was a case. Journalists were briefed to say this, and so many of them did say it in reporting it. It was a sign of the United States being back in the driver's seat, was the phrase that was often used in the briefings, and commentators very willingly passed that idea on. And indeed, you know, the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, was very, very clear about saying that and welcoming the United States back into international discourse about climate after 4 years of Trump, of course, pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement and treating climate change as a so-called hoax, and all the lunacy that came from that. You have a United States giving out, of course, what you rightly describe as a big ask. The citizens of the United States are to halve our greenhouse gas emissions by the end of this decade, working from, of course, the traditional baseline of what our emissions were in 2005, cutting it by half. That's an extraordinary ambition, and in order to do it, of course, it's going to be huge and demanding on our established way of life. Rightly, I think, we're going to have to get used to doing things very differently. Just in the matter of switching from the internal combustion engine for our cars and other forms of road transport, trucks and buses and all the rest, to electricity is a mind-boggling concept, particularly on that timescale. It's going to be extraordinary. And of course, we're not the only ones. One interesting announcement coming in time for that summit too was President Macron in France is now ordering jet travel to be halted for any journey that you could do by train in France. That wouldn't take more than, I think, the 2.5 hour circumference mark is what judges it. If you can do the journey by train in less than 2.5 hours, there will be no jet service. That's a remarkable notion, and I wonder what effect it would have if it were suggested for Americans. I suspect there might be something of a rebellion, but it does show that this administration does appear to mean business. And interestingly, on the international stage, if you like, and much of this is performance art, of course. As a Brit, I have to point out that Biden has very effectively taken the wind out of the sails, so to speak, if I can use that metaphor in a climate context, for the United Kingdom's Boris Johnson. He's been planning and very much, very evidently looking forward, jubilantly to a November summit, which has been long planned in the perhaps surprising setting of the Scottish city of Glasgow. But he's been somewhat upstaged here in April by this very assertive piece of international policy setting by President Biden.
We'll come back to policy, and sometimes you just can't explain stupid. COVID-19, the hate crimes bill against Asian Americans, passed the United States Senate by a vote of 94-1. The one
extraordinary bipartisanship for a change,
yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah. Now, the one lone vote comes from Josh Hawley, the Republican, who said it was too broad.
Bipartisanship and Josh Hawley do not sit well in the same sentence, do they? No.
It's pretty amazing that that in this day and age, something as really apparent as this gets a senator to vote against it. He would have been much wiser just to abstain rather
yeah,
than vote.
He's against a piece of legislation designed to stop people being killed in hate crimes. It tells us in a very, very fundamental kind of way exactly what we're dealing with in Senator Josh Hawley. It couldn't be clearer, I guess. It says all that needs to be said about this particular politician, I think.
You know, I want to come back here and congratulate NASA for working with a private company, SpaceX, this morning. A successful liftoff carrying four astronauts to the space station. It'll take them about a day to get there. But this is something that people poo-pooed the idea in the beginning, but this is one thing that Elon Musk has done extremely well, which is really saving the country money and helping NASA resume its programs.
Yeah, and an example of the kind of collaboration that used to be poo-pooed by hardliners, I guess, on both sides of the equation, about public-private partnership. lots of taxpayers' money going into this, but also private enterprise having a lot of skin in the game, too. One small element of this whole exercise, this dramatic and very inspiring exercise, been pointed out by some journalists who, I like journalists who focus on detail, and it's interesting to discover that the International Space Station that these four astronauts are aiming for and will be bedded down in for 6 months, I think, is getting very overcrowded now. There isn't quite enough bed space for them all. That's an interesting revelation. So clearly there's need for more accommodation up there if we're going to keep on doing this.
And what's interesting, and what most people don't realize, Russia, who is a partner in the International Space Station, has pulled out of that. They are going to launch their own space station. So they've pulled out of the International Space Station. I always thought that space station was a great idea simply because it could bring countries together on another plane other than politics, which is much easier to do, which leads to better relations, really.
Yeah, well, it's a sign of the times, I guess, particularly the sign of Russia's, how Russia sees its place in the world. And of course, it's been a tense week when you look towards Russia now. at Biden's under Biden's chairing, President Putin was remarkably sort of polite, I guess, and well behaved in his contribution to the International Climate Summit, but he was acting in a sense out of character in a week when his forces have been massing in a threatening way along the border with Ukraine, and that part of Eastern Europe is still very tense because, as often, Russia's in very, very firm intent of keeping its influence strong and assertive, indeed aggressive, in that sphere of influence. And as a result, a lot of anxiety about what may happen in that Ukraine arena. And back at home, of course, the iron fist is being clenched yet again in the matter of the main, in fact, probably the only opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, in prison, sick, and on hunger strike, and contention over whether or not he's going to get proper medical attention from a doctor he can trust, and of course all of that underlines Russia's role as something of a rogue element in the international realm of cooperation.
Yeah, I want to also just, it's nice to see the State Department working as a State Department, because even though we have policy issues, big policy issues with China and with Russia, now the President of the United States has allowed the State Department to proceed with working with these countries possibly on other things other than the things we don't agree on, to make the world really a better and safer place and more communicable.
Sure, diplomacy is back. That's the message of all these briefings that journalists are getting from the State Department and from the White House, and indeed from the Energy Department, which is in one sense the lead agency for climate change measures. But it does work much more broadly than that, as you say, all sorts of areas in which nations have to cooperate if we want a peaceful and effective world, and that's happening with active help from American diplomats now, and yet again, I think we're saying it even now as we approach next Tuesday, which will be 100 days of the Biden administration. It still feels fairly new that ordinary, sensible government measures are being taken by the government that we elected.
I want to wrap this show up with a I find funny, but it's not really a funny story. Northumberland Long Ridge Towers, I guess in England, I'm not sure. Their school trip was to Costa Rica. Their IT teacher was sent home early and banned because he brought the class to a strip club, and he admitted once he did that he was drunk.
oh, you don't say.
He admitted that he committed gross conduct, and he was fired. This dates back to 2019, but the story is just coming out. It is a private school that costs about £5,000 a day for pupils to attend.
Well, in some ways it's serious. Teachers are meant to be a good example, but I can't help looking back at my teenage years when we went on a school trip to France, and the two teachers who were our chaperones were not exactly well behaved in French towns themselves. So I think it's a matter of plus ça change, right? The more things change, the more they change, they stay the same.
All right, David, have a good week. We'll speak to you next week.
Yes, indeed.
Take care. David Tarachuk with the Media Beat today here on Robin Hood Radio. Of course, you can find David at his website, themediabeat.us, and here at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand, The Media Beat with David Tarachuk.